Judge Reyes, Judge Ross, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, June 6, 2024. We have five cases on our calendar today. Three are set for oral argument. This is the first of those three. This is A23-1411, State of Minnesota versus Kyle Lloyd Petterling. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. There is a clock in one of the squares, so feel free to use that to be mindful of how much time you have. This is being live streamed, and there will be an audio recording of it as well. However, no other recordings, either audio or visual or both, are permitted without the court's permission. If we do run into technical difficulties, which sometimes does happen because we are doing this via Zoom, we will certainly make sure that we get everybody on board and allow the appropriate amount of time for each of the parties. I just want to verify also, in light of that I can hear both of you. Counsel for appellant, if you could just speak up.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Okay, counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Okay, perfect. We can see and hear both of you. With that, counsel for appellant, you have 15 minutes and you may proceed by stating your name and the party you are representing.
May it please the court, Your Honor, counsel. My name is John Munnins, and I represent the appellant, Kyle Ketterling, in today's case. We respectfully request that this court reverse Mr. Ketterling's convictions because the district court erred when it found that Mr. Ketterling's social media posts were not protected by the First Amendment. Additionally, the state failed to present sufficient evidence that there was a reasonable apprehension that Mr. Ketterling would follow through on any of the charged threats, and that Mr. Ketterling's alleged charged threats occurred in Olmsted County. At trial, there was no evidence submitted of where Mr. Ketterling was when he made the charged posts to his social media Getter account. Additionally, there was no evidence submitted of where the charged posts were actually received or read by someone online. Finally, there was no evidence whether anyone ever even read the charged posts for which Mr. Ketterling was convicted.
But counsel, didn't appellant admit that he has lived his entire life in Rochester?
He did.
Okay, why isn't that sufficient to establish venue? If he's lived his entire life there, when the police went to his home, his residence, he was there. Why isn't that sufficient?
Because the charge posts take place on specific days. And Mr. Ketterling, even in that same interview, indicates that he only posts to his social media from his cell phone. They actually did obtain a computer, or at least that's what they say in the interview, that they obtained a home computer. No evidence was submitted from that home computer that would show that any of the social media posts occurred at his residence. And we live in a world where social media is readily available on your cell phone, and you can post it anywhere in the world so long as you have access to the internet. He could have been outside of Olmsted County. In one of the posts, he talks about maybe moving to Wisconsin or one of the Dakotas. He could have been there. He frankly could have been in Canada. There is just, it's pure speculation to believe that on a particular day, on a particular time, that he must have been at his residence posting to his social media account. That's just not enough for them to make a rational inference that he had made these posts from Olmsted County.
I know, Mr. Moens, that you talk about the Pierce case,
Correct.
and we know that this issue, and you both have acknowledged this, is before the Supreme Court on venue. But Pierce is our precedent. But it seems to me that there is a more here than in Pierce. In Pierce, it was just the address was in one document, and you would agree that there's more here than in Pierce, correct? There's, one of his posts talked about being down here, and I think it was Rochester, he put it, as well as where he was arrested and that he lived in Minnesota.
So I would certainly agree that some of the posts indicate more than you would have in Pierce. However, here we have three specific charged posts. In those charged posts, he never makes a comment of where he is when he's posting them, or where he might be, around that time even. So we're really kind of in the same world as Pierce, where the state did not prove where the victim actually received the, in Pierce, it was a similar social media, it was MySpace messages, you know, or emails, messages through MySpace. State did not submit any evidence of where she received those or where they would have been made. This is evidence that is obtainable, and in theory may have been obtainable here. The records custodian from Getter testified that when they get these requests, they give whatever information they have available. The words that he uses are IP addresses, if available. But yet the IP addresses were redacted from Exhibit 21. They're not submitted at the district court. They aren't explained. No one can tell us where they ping to or where someone might have been on a particular post. You know, that kind of evidence would have shown where Mr. Ketterling was when he made these posts. Maybe it was in Rochester. Maybe he was further south. Maybe he was up north in the Twin Cities. It's unclear from the record.
If I may, you started out, I think, answering my question with saying we're talking about three posts here. And I just wanted to get both of your perspectives, but beginning with you. Are we talking about three posts here? Because we've got the post that was grounded in count two, but that was the only guilty verdict that was adjudicated. The verdicts with regard to count three and four, as I understand it, were unadjudicated. So in the absence of conviction, are those verdicts, those convictions, as opposed to verdicts, really before us?
Yes, that's fair. And I do note that in my brief that he was not actually adjudicated guilty on counts three and four. It was only on count two. So narrowly speaking, count two is before you. I do ask this court, just in really the effort of judicial efficiency, to address three and four, because really what we're talking about are almost the same arguments that would apply. I mean, the same evidence as to venue came in on all three counts, or lack of evidence. The same lack of evidence that anyone even read the posts are the same for counts two, three, and four. The First Amendment claim, the analysis is essentially the same as the counts two, three, and four. So we do ask that this court address three and four to avoid me having to come back two more times on the same issues. But you are correct, and I do acknowledge that in my brief, that count two is the one for which he was adjudicated guilty, or actually convicted of and sentenced.
Counsel, does that fall into the category of be careful what you ask for? Because it seems to me that you even acknowledge that counts three and four are more specific than count two in terms of the details of who is being targeted, and it seems to have more specific information. It seems that there potentially could be even a stronger argument that counts three and four have even more sufficient evidence to support them than count two.
I respectfully disagree that they have more sufficient evidence. The First Amendment analysis might change ever so slightly. However, the evidence is the same. Again, there's no evidence that anyone read any one of these charged posts.
Well, let's put that aside in the venue issue. I want to ask a general question on the constitutional as applied challenge. What does it mean when we say in context, looking at the charges in context? Do we look at the counts in isolation, or can we look to the other counts or the, you know, over 500 pages of posts to provide context? It's not clear to me from the briefing how we're supposed to approach that in context issue.
And yes, and I think it's more clear in a situation. So I do think you get to look at posts certainly that are related to one another. And it's certainly more clear, you know, when we look at the context in a threats case where, for instance, some two people get into it at a bar and someone says they're going to stab someone or shoot someone or whatever it might be. You know, there's more context there. What was their manner? What was their tone? How far away they were? It's easier when you're in a physical space to discern the context. Here, where we just have social media posts, I think the context is really, what is Mr. Ketterling talking about when he's making these posts? And what he's talking about is how he sees a civil war basically coming to the United States in that summer of 2022. And he is essentially readying his followers for that civil war. And he believes, rightfully or wrongfully, it doesn't matter what we think, or even his listeners, he believes that that civil war will be a violent one, and that in order for his, you know, political views to succeed, they will have to engage in that violence. Similar to Brandenburg, where the courts say, you know, basically the First Amendment allows for someone to advocate for the use of force or violation of laws, and they can even teach, you know, the moral propriety or moral necessity are the words that Brandenburg's used for the resort to force or violence.
I mean,
it
seems that your argument might have some bearing on count one, which the jury agreed with your client as to the quality of that charge. But, you know, when you look at the texts of counts two and three, I'm trying to get a sense in the language of those texts how you can argue that this is a sort of a general concern about a theoretical civil war when, you know, there's I'm going to kill you myself.
So just to clarify, Judge Ross, that is the original count two, which was actually dismissed after the state rested its case in chief. A person does post and he responds to that post and says, we're going to find you. We know where you live. If someone else doesn't find you first, I believe is what he says, I'm going to find you and kill you. I actually do agree that that is a good example of what is likely a true threat. It is directed at the person.
Let's look at count three then. You're right. That was a substitute. So we will hunt you down and kill you, man, woman, or child. I mean, this is not a, it doesn't sound like a theoretical, you know, there's going to be a civil war and people are going to die. It seems pretty specific. And the class of individuals is identified as well. Why is that not different from a theoretical, I think violence is going to come, and when it does, people are going to be harmed?
I believe it gets back to Judge Reyes's question about what context we look at here. And if you look at his post throughout, he talks about a civil war coming and how at that point, people are going to die.
But in this specific post, this is a warning to a specific religious group, every Muslim: assimilate, leave this country, or we will hunt you down and kill you. Man, woman, or child, everyone, we're going to do this if you do not assimilate. How is that not a specific threat that differs from a theoretical, there's going to be violence?
Because again, if it's a future tense, this is what we are going to do. And I think you have to look at the context of what he is saying will happen.
Isn't every threat about a future event?
Yes, but again, if you look at the context, so I'm going to stab you is a great example of a threat. But if someone is maybe brandishing a weapon or near a weapon or has one on their waist, there are other contexts to show that the immediacy of that threat makes it a true threat.
Well, going back to count two, we do have the immediacy. And in fact, we have a number of different parties, the FBI, the local police, that reasonable believe that there was a threat that was going to occur by May 22nd, and they acted quickly based on that information, and that relates to count two. And not only that, they were able to obtain a warrant which had been signed off by a judicial officer. So even a judicial officer had signed off on the search warrant in response to this threat. So that seems pretty concrete when you're talking about a specific date, that if something doesn't happen, we will start killing anyone and everyone. And when you talk about the context, it's pretty clear that he's targeting Muslims in particular, but also state and government officials. So why, if officers had a concern, why doesn't that meet the standard of, you know, laid out under Brzezinski?
So I, first of all, disagree that the officers ever testified that they had a fear of this post. The May 22nd.
Well, I think that they did because they took action. The action they took, I think, speak to their concern.
But nobody says they ever read that post that was count two. And if you look at the posts, exhibit 3 through 13 and 17 and 18, those are the only posts that Sergeant Pankratz actually testifies to having reviewed. The May 22nd date is in there. He talks about all these types of things in there. He threatens CIA agents. He says if any government actor comes to his door, someone is going to end up dead. He talks about shooting randomly dead federal employees, state employees. And he talks about how on May 22nd, President Biden is going to give away the security of our nation to the World Health Organization or the United Nations or NATO. These are the conditions precedent to that May 22nd date. And it's just not reasonable to believe that that's going to happen. That's, you have to have a reasonable apprehension. And it's like in Watts, in Watts, they said it was his threat of threatening the president in that situation was based on things that simply weren't going to happen. Watts had already said he was going to dodge the draft. He wasn't going to report. But then he says, well, if I do go and you give me a gun, the first person in my sights is going to be the president. It's just not realistic. And here, it's just not realistic to believe that the president is going to sign away the sovereignty of or security of the United States to the World Health Organization or NATO. And so we need to have that condition.
If I may, just because we have limited times, because I did want to ask, get a chance to ask you this question. It just strikes me that perhaps you're trying to have it both ways to say, well, when we are looking at whether this is a protected speech, we have to look at, the context of all of this. Really, it's talking about anticipating a civil war. It's about politics, but when it comes to addressing reasonable apprehension, we just have to look at this specific post. Did an officer or someone say they felt threatened by that specific post? Could you help me with that?
My time is up, if I can briefly respond.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I think the difference, Judge, is that when we come to the reasonable apprehension, that is a specific charge. So the state needs to prove reasonable apprehension as to each count. So they do have to prove reasonable apprehension to that specific post. Whereas when we're doing the First Amendment analysis, we look at the post in its context to see, if it's a true threat, basically. Thank you.
I do have one follow-up question myself. You argue that for post two, for count two, the post, that it was conditional, a condition that was never going to happen. But the post talks about election being decertified by May 22nd, and President Biden was duly elected in January. So the likelihood of decertification was near zero. So that doesn't seem to be conditional, unlike the cases that you cite. In fact, it seems that because there is not going to be any decertification, that he would then start following through on his promise, as he his warning and a promise, to start killing people. So why is it not conditional then?
Because it's not just one condition that the election be decertified. You have to look at why he wants the election decertified. And it's because he believes that President Biden is going to give up the sovereignty of the United States.
But that's not part of the post. That goes to Judge Jessen's question. That's not part of the post. If we're just looking at this post in isolation, it just talks about decertification.
If we're only looking at that post, I'd still just stand by the fact that Sergeant Pankratz never read that post. And so no one was in reasonable apprehension. And it's important to note that moderators can pull these down. I mean, we don't even know if anyone read it or if it ever stayed up. There's just not enough evidence in the record.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes, and please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. May it please counsel as well. Forgive me for not omitting you. I cued in on Judge Reyes's observation that this matter had been signed off by a judicial officer. I think when you examine index number one, the original complaint, it gives you a sense of urgency here. We normally e-file complaints. If you look at this document, it's a paper template from the 5th Judicial District that someone scratched out 5th and hand wrote 3rd. The court file number is you know, handwritten in as well. And if you scroll down to the bottom, you can see where things are handwritten and ink signed. That's not the typical course of business. There was a sense of urgency to get this complaint warrant signed by a judge. My inference here is probably an after hours effort to get this done quickly.
How would the sense of urgency bear on any of the issues that we face?
Oh, because one of the postings, the one that ultimately was the focus of the count two, the amended count two, that is the subject of our conviction, had a deadline that if the election was not decertified by May 22nd, that they would start killing anyone and everyone that they felt was involved with the deep state. This was the temporal sense of urgency. And I disagree with the assertion that nobody read this. This was known to the police officers. It was known to the prosecutors. This was what was driving the timing of this. And I think the testimony reflects that they understood, and there was references to this May 22nd date. I think it's important to note that this complaint, while hurriedly put together and giving a date of May 17th, all those postings were available on Getter on May 17th. The original complaint was a broadly stated complaint referencing many various posts. It didn't specifically hone in on one, and it looked at the entire context. As I think you can tell from the transcript, the trial prosecutors decided as a tactical matter to make things more focused for the jury and to avoid any arguments about unanimity, because there were just hundreds of posts, and decided to just narrow it to some specific posts and agree that this there would just be one conviction here. This would be a single behavioral incident, but it allowed the jurors and the court to hone in on some of the more salient posts. But that's not to say that it takes out the context of the other hundreds of posts that were presented to the jury in the exhibits. Now,
before you get further into your argument, I want to ask you as well, as I think you understand, under our precedent, including a presidential case earlier this year, in the absence of conviction, defendant doesn't have the right to appellate review of a guilty verdict. Are you also asking us to set that aside in the interest of justice and address the guilty verdicts underlying counts 3 and 4?
Well, I did not specifically address them in my brief, as the court, I think, could see. I understand, appellant's request to do that. And I'm a believer of judicial economy as well. So I don't know. I really don't have a strong position on that. I tend to think count two, in my mind, is the most persuasive to me, because it has this hard deadline. I guess if you're unpersuaded on count two, we could.
So I what that is one of the reasons I ask is I see some distinctions between them. You know, count two, the amended post, but one, it's tied to an election, which, you know, you could argue might be more kind of in the political speech realm under a First Amendment analysis. And it's not as specifically targeted. I mean, it says anyone involved with the deep state. Well, I mean, there's a lot of debate about whether there is a deep state. And, you know, I think harder to even believe that to say who's involved with it, as opposed to what's underlying counts 3 and 4, which are very specifically targeting both people and groups. So that's the reason I ask you.
Well, I guess I'll leave that to the court's broad discretion as to how it wants to address counts 2 and 3. I don't think it's an unfair request on the part of the appellant to take a broader look at it. I tried to focus on count two.
My concerns from a First Amendment perspective about the post underlying count two, which is clearly.
Okay. Anyway, I was kind of just talking about the broader context of how we'd amended the complaint to hone in on that particular post, but it comes in the context of many, many other posts. Now, I'll be the first to admit that most of these posts I find to be political speech. Some may find them grotesque or offensive, but I think much of what Mr. Ketterling was posting is clearly First Amendment protected speech, but boy, it gets close to the line.
I'm sorry. I don't want to go ahead and finish that thought before I ask.
Well, my punchline was to say, and that's what this case is about, is posts that in context cross that line. And that's what makes this an interesting and I think somewhat complicated case because of this context.
So your venue argument, you defend the venue element on several theories. Which one do you think is the strongest theory?
Well, it's not every day that we get a unanimous United States Supreme Court decision that speaks directly to this issue. But I personally think that the United States Supreme Court decision in Smith is a strong explanation of the vicinage venue clauses and how it applies here. I've argued my brief and we have limited time. I think the California model is the approach I would urge this court to consider. And I understand, appreciate that maybe this isn't the forum for that sort of policy change, but the United States Supreme Court said, look, when you're a criminal defendant and you're convicted by a jury in the wrong venue, your right is a new trial. Double jeopardy does not attach. So one has to ask, how can venue be a substantive element of the crime when it's like a trial right? You get a new trial. It's because it bears nothing on guilt or innocence, other than those very narrow crimes.
So you're arguing the legal point that, of course, our Supreme Court's going to decide. But I'm looking more at the practical bases. Sure. Assuming the court doesn't change our approach, you have different theories for why the venue element was satisfied as a matter of fact in this case.
The strongest argument there would relate to that Johnson case, and it's where the threats were apprehended and received. The jury instruction in this case, of course, is that I just had it. It's where whether there was a reasonable apprehension that the defendant would carry out these threats, whether the defendant's words or actions created a reasonable apprehension that the defendant would follow through with or act on the threat. The reasonable apprehension for this element occurred in Olmsted County. It's where it was reviewed by Rochester police officers, by local FBI agents, by the prosecutor, Mr. Woodford, who signed this complaint, by Judge Chase, who signed it quickly so that the police officers...
When you have a threat, when one individual is threatening another individual and law enforcement intercept the threat, and let's say this threat was towards whoever, a specific Joe Smith, and Joe Smith doesn't see it, but the police capture the communication in a certain location. You believe that when the officers capture that location, or capture that communication where the officers are at that time establishes venue?
Yes.
Not the target?
Correct. And I think that's...
What's the legal support for that?
Well, I looked to this court's decision, and Pierce talked about that. That's what I find significant about the Pierce case, was that it was the destination. It was where it was received, not just the location from which it was sent.
Right, but it was where it was received. And the idea, I thought, in Pierce was the recipients, the targets were at a certain location, not law enforcement, who may be enforcing the law and criminalizing the communication.
And again, in Pierce, the court found there was insufficient evidence because there just simply wasn't in the record. But it rejected the appellant's argument there that it had to be the location of origin of the complaint. Where that was developed further was in the Johnson case.
I'm understanding that. I'm assuming that's true, that it can be the location where the message was received, where the person who is the target, the person who would have some apprehension about the communication. Pierce makes that clear, that is the law as we have it right now. My question for you is, you seem to be suggesting that law enforcement who intercept the communication can be a stand-in substitute for the individual who would other who is the target of the communication. And I'm wondering if there's some why you believe there's precedent for that. And if there's not, I mean, if you're correct, it seems that venue would never be a problem because law enforcement anywhere can look at the communication and say, well, look, I happen to be in, I'm in Hennepin County when I read the communication. So even though Hennepin County is not the target, venue is appropriate in Hennepin County based on your theory, I think. I'm not sure that's correct. If it is correct, provide me the law.
Well, and maybe if we adjusted the hypothetical court gave was a threat to a particular individual person, for example. I think of this, you know, for most of my life, I think of this as the old, what we call terroristic threats statute, which kind of originated with some bomb threats, those sorts of things against the public. This particular count, the victims, if you want to call it that, were anyone and everyone we feel is involved with the deep state. Well, that could be me. That could be the people that work at the government center, judges, police officers. And, you know, does it to say that, you know, I'm going to blow up the government center unless you decertify the election, I'm going to blow up the government center in Olmsted County. I mean, the government center is not a victim. It can't read it, but police are going to see that. And that's clearly a bomb threat. It's clearly right. a terroristic threat.
It's targeted toward a group. And in that hypothetical that you've given, those who are associated with the location are the target. I don't see that. I mean, you're saying that's what's going on in this particular threat in count under count two?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the location of its apprehension is the appropriate situs for the case.
I know you're saying that, but I'm looking at something different. I'm talking about in law enforcement. Your argument was, well, you know, the police looked at it, the prosecutor looked at it, the judge looked at it, and therefore, I guess what you're saying is anywhere where police and prosecution and judicial officers look at it are locations where venue is proper. Without regard, your argument seemed to me it didn't regard who the target was. And I'm just wondering whether there's any case law that supports that. Mm-hmm. And why it seems like your explanation would swallow the venue rule. There would never be a challenge to venue under that rule because judges are everywhere and prosecutors are everywhere and police are everywhere. So venue would be proper anywhere.
Well,
is there some authority to support your theory?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I first start off with, you know, there was no objection to it being tried in this county. And again, we're conflating two different concepts. You're focusing on the element of proof, if you will.
Well, that's the argument that's being raised on appeal. There's no proof to support venue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess our position is that the deep state could be these officers in Olmsted County. I mean, I don't know that there's a lot of dispute that Mr. Ketterling has, you know, lived at home his whole life here in Rochester. He's here. The deep state people with whom he has concerns, he does list in his various rantings, various public officials. But I think, yes, I think if police officers in a venue where the defendant is located, I mean, the court's question takes it a little bit out of context, the rest of the fact that Mr. Ketterling lives here. And there's really no information to suggest he was anywhere else. I think the jury's inference on the evidence here is sufficient to say, well, he was arrested at the home. He says he's lived here his whole life. I think that's sufficient for the jury to conclude that this is the proper situs for this trial.
Counsel, yeah. I do have one quick question. I know we're running out of time, and I think Judge Jessen may have a question as well. But my question for you is the district court used the Morzinski three-part test to analyze the true threats. But in that case, that was the constitutional challenge was not as applied as it is here. Is that the proper test to be used in this case to analyze the true threats component?
Well, it was the closest thing I could come up with. It's the fresh. I see there's two aspects. I mean, if I think I'm going to run out of time, may I finish the question?
Yes, yeah.
I see the appellant's argument twofold. The first part is, does this fall within the true threats exception in the first place, or is it just on its face sort of thing that's protected speech. And I think that's the Mrozinski application there is very important because they're trying to discern what is a true threat such that the reckless standard is applicable. And that three-pronged test, I think, was applied to try to define, if you will, what we mean as a true threat. Now, reasonableness crosses over to the second argument, which is, all right, is the evidence sufficient that the defendant's words or actions created a reasonable apprehension that Mr. Ketterling would follow through with the threats? But that's one of the prongs of the Mrozinski test in the first place as to whether this qualifies under the true threat. So I think there's broad overlap between those concepts. I think it is an appropriate test, though, just at the outset to say, do we even get up to bat? I mean, is this protected speech on its face, or is there a basis to think this falls outside the definition? Then secondly, we hone in more specifically on the element of the reasonable apprehension. But again, that's part of the Mrozinski test.
Thank you. And I think Judge Jessen had a question. No? Okay, it doesn't look like there are any other questions. Thank you, counsel. We will now turn back to appellant's counsel, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with Judge Ross's inquiry about the venue issue here when we have a reasonable apprehension element that can be met. It would be appellant's position that, frankly, the officer's reasonable apprehension is really never going to satisfy that element. And it's for the exact point that Judge Ross was pointing out.
Unless we construe anyone and everyone we feel involved with the deep state to include officers, then we would incorporate their apprehension as a basis for venue, correct?
Correct. And you can imagine there are other threats too. The case eludes me right now, but threats against police officers or police departments specifically that were made on social media, you know, there, when it's directed at law enforcement, certainly they're the receiver, the victim.
You've got a broad category. Anyone and everyone we feel is involved with the deep state. So why wouldn't law enforcement be included? I mean, law enforcement is sort of the arm of government, whatever you think of as the deep state, whatever that is. Presumably there's some enforcement arm, and law enforcement would presumably be part of that. The judicial system would be part of that. So why wouldn't, as the respondent's arguing here, why wouldn't judges, why wouldn't officers be part of that target that might be included in this particular case to establish venue?
Frankly, I'm not sure who the deep state is or who is involved with the deep state or who might qualify. But I think at the very least, Judge, what you would need is, for instance, Sergeant Pankratz to say, I read this and I was worried that because he's going to attack the deep state, that includes Rochester Police Department. And that way you would have an apprehension of an actual victim. And then it's up to the jury then to make a factual finding as to whether or not that apprehension is reasonable. And we see this play out in Mrozinski
I'm just talking about venue here. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about whether or not there's enough evidence to support the substantive crime. We're talking about the element of venue. Why wouldn't wouldn't this be enough as a threat is framed for the warning or whatever you want to call it, for the jury to say, you know what, that's enough for me to incorporate anyone who happens to be, you know, if it's anyone and everyone that this Mr. Ketterling feels is part of the deep state, and you read all the other texts and communications, and the jury has access to other information, why wouldn't this be enough for the jury at least to conclude, you know, law enforcement could be part of it, you know, sufficiency of the evidence on this element, that's enough?
Because exactly your point. So venue can be proved kind of, you know, multiple ways. Either the acts actually occurred in Olmsted County or an element occurs in Olmsted County. And the state's argument here seems to be that the element of reasonable apprehension occurred in Olmsted County, which gives them venue. So they have to prove that that element existed in Olmsted County in order to meet their venue. They could have proved venue by showing where they were posted or that, you know, the actual charged posts were received in Olmsted County. They didn't do that. So then they are left with basically showing that the reasonable apprehension element must have occurred in Olmsted County. And I think they run into a lot of problems there, both in proof of the actual element itself or that it occurred in Olmsted County. I mean, the problem here is that if there is a threat communicated in the world, you know, I'm at the VFW in Hastings and someone threatens to kill me, I don't get to go to MPD in my hometown, Minneapolis, and say, hey, this guy threatened me down in Hastings. That's just not how the law works. The Minneapolis police would rightfully say, you better go back to Hastings and report your crime. Just because law enforcement is aware of something doesn't just automatically give them venue. And frankly, we always want law enforcement to investigate a potential threat. So they always have, I mean, part of their job is to have some apprehension when a potential threat comes on their desk. That's okay. But that doesn't alleviate the state's burden of proof at trial to prove every essential element beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what the state failed to do here. That's the problem. It's not, the problem isn't even them executing a search warrant. It's not a PC issue. It's a matter of whether or not the state at trial, not talking about a paper complaint, not talking about a county attorney signing off on a complaint. We're talking about whether they submitted sufficient evidence to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. They don't have a victim who then said it was they were apprehended or had a reasonable apprehension, and they don't have venue. And that's the problem with their case. Thank you.
If I may, Judge Reyes, may I ask one additional question?
Yes, please.
Mr. Mullins, I was going thinking back to something you talked about in your original argument, and you said that the original post on count two, now that's the sort of thing that would be a true threat. But I'm looking at, and that's the one that starts out, you know, you are dead, we are coming for you, my buddy just found out who you are, that one. Mm-hmm. But how is that any different from a First Amendment perspective here, you know, from count three, which specifically talks about Ellison and Omar are on our kill lists. I mean, that's very specific too. So why would the original count two charge be a true threat and what's underlying count three not be?
I think the shortest answer is the political nature of the statement versus the private nature of the original count two. You know, directing a threat at an individual for their speech saying, I'm going to kill you because you made that post. I think that's a pretty clear or certainly a more clear true threat, which the district court found no reasonable apprehension was proven nor venue. Whereas when we get to kill lists and things, I mean, then we're in the world of protests where you might see death to, you know, name your political candidate. It's the world we live in. It's the world we tolerate. The First Amendment gives us that right, whether we like it or not. And we can't criminalize just words. You have to criminalize an actus rea that actually instills some harm into the community.
Any other questions from the panel?
Many, but we're out of time.
Thank you both very much for your oral arguments and your briefing. We appreciate it. We'll be taking the matter under advisement and issuing an opinion within the mandatory, the statutory mandatory 90-day timeframe. Thank you both.
Thank you.